There are some of those game design books that are like dictionaries. There are some that are just books of essays, you know, like Eric Lang saying, well, you know, what I would do is this, but usually like the people that are at the top of their game, you know, the Eric Langs and the Rob Davios and the Vlada Shivadals and the, you know, all the Euro game designers that are very popular. Their advice is from a position that is not relevant to a starting or mid game designer. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, I remember an interview I saw with Shigeru Miyamoto, and he essentially was like, well, in order to be successful, you need to like work for Nintendo. and that's like, well, that's not going to help anybody, right? Like, cause that you're in a position, you have access to technology and you have access to people and things like that, that other people don't. And so essentially that's like saying, in order to be successful, you need to be a success, which is true, but lousy advice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, Rainer Knizia, I think, talks about, or has a quote that you want to kind of, when you're coming up, you actually want to be working with smaller publishers. Because they'll pay more attention to your game, but then, you know, and kind of work your way up to the bigger ones.
Yes, yes. But Rainer Knizia also has an army of people helping him make games. So he's, you know, making. I mean, there's a reason why the man has made. What is it now? Are we almost at 700?
I think it's about 700. Yeah, but that does count a lot of like a lot of those are like magazine reprints. Games and exactly.
Well, he lucked. I mean, I'm not going to say he lucked out, but he happened to be in the industry at a time when it was easier to kind of pump out stuff. And I mean, his quality is, you know, that's part of the reason why he's so famous and well respected, is his quality is very high, regardless of the stuff he does. He's had some, you know, a couple of bummers, but for the most part, you know, he's probably had more well-made games than not, but he still had an opportunity to kind of, you know, they say in order to be a good writer, you need to read like 1,000 books or something like that. Or to be a good artist, you need to draw like 1,000 crappy pictures. So Panizia, I think, had that opportunity through all those gaming magazines to do his crappy games, right? To kind of get those out of the system and learn from mistakes and things like that. And as a result, the stuff that we see from him, or at least the things that, you know, he's known for is his, you know, the cream of the crop, right? We don't know about those little tiny micro games that he made for, you know, Spiel magazine and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. By the way, I'm already recording because I found it interesting. Just so you know,
that's the danger of talking to me. I always have something interesting to say from the start. So
yeah, no, it's perfect. I'm just making you aware. You know, if you want to,
that's fine.
Badmouth anybody, it's going to be recorded.
Yeah, no, I'm not in the habit of badmouthing.
I know.
The game industry is too small, and not everybody knows each other, but everybody can find out about each other very quickly.
Yeah, for sure.
And so it doesn't behoove anybody to talk bad. I mean, you know, there's some bad actors and there's definitely bad games, but what good does it do to say, you know, hey, this is bad. It's, you know, I think we, it's better for all of us to kind of like raise each other up and talk as best we can about each other, or just keep your mouth shut.
And,
you know, if you don't like something, just be quiet. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course.
I don't know. That's my motto. I've kind of lived that way through my life in video games, and I'm trying to live my life that way through my board game career.
I think that's a great way to live your life.
I think it's a great way to live your life in general, right? Even if you're not making board games.
Yeah. Yeah. So the topic of games, usually I'm interested in hearing how you got into games and like what got you playing at first, and then what got you wanting to design games, what got you into teaching games and so on.
I have a very long story I could tell about how I got into games, but I will keep it short because I'm sure there's a lot of other things you want to talk about. I've always been interested in board games. Some of my earliest memories are playing board games. I talk about it in your turn. I was in high school and I worked for a store called The Gamekeeper, and the owner had me read all the rule books of the games that we were selling. So I became very well versed in just, you know, how to play games and a wide variety of games. This is in the, I'm old, so this is in the early 80s. So I was right at the right, like kind of at the crest of the beginning of the hobby game market, what we, you know, kind of the hobby game market as we know it today. And that was, you know, things like the Game Master series from Elton Bradley and all the early Games Workshop things like Talisman, Dungeon Quest, and Blood Bowl, and all those really cool games. So I got exposed to those very early on. And then I worked in video games for a long during my work in video games. I ended up living in the Bay Area. And I had I have a very good friend who is a huge game collector. He's got I think his collection is getting close to 2,000 titles now, which is, you know, there's people that have more, but 2,000 is pretty impressive. And so we would just play everything. We just, you know, I'm the type of gamer, I'll play anything. Mm. And so he would just bring out everything. And so everything from Euros to, you know, what I still like to call Ameritrash, just classic card games and dice games and things like that. So my education hyper accelerated. And of course, I am a firm believer that the more games you play, the more you're going to want to make them. And so I started working on a little card game, and I live in Los Angeles. And I went to for like 2 years, it was a Gen Con in LA. And so I went with my games. I had like 3 or 4 games that I was playtesting. And I had playtest sessions. And then I went around to there were maybe like 5 publishers at this Gen Con. Mm-hmm. And I went around to all 5 of them and showed them my games. And they were like, thank you, no thank you. And that was the end of that. And so I went back to Gen Con. They had 2 Gen Cons, and so I went back the second year, and one of the publishers came up to me and said, you know, I'm so glad I ran into you. I've been thinking about your game all year.
Wow.
I love it. I love the theme. It's very interesting. I want to license your game. And so I didn't know much about how that all worked at that time, but I licensed it to him for no money, which was a big mistake. But fortunately, I've learned better since then. And he held on to it for like 3 years. And then the 2008 financial crisis hit. And he was like, I have to tighten up my business. I can't concentrate on more than this one game that was successful for them. So he gave me the rights back to my card game. So I almost made a sale back in the early 2000s, but I didn't. And then I ended up I worked for Disney for about 5 years. And Disney is very, shall we say, draconian in their rights, you know, when it comes to rights to things. So I knew that I didn't want to publish anything while I was kind of under the shadow of the mouse. Mm. But I, in the middle of that, I got Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is a cancer, blood cancer. And so I was on disability, and I was like, you know, I have this game that I really wanted to make as a video game, but everybody kept kind of turning it down, partially because the technology wasn't there yet to make it. So I said, well, if I can't make it as a video game, I'll make it as a board game. So I designed this game called Ray Guns and Rocket Ships. And I went, after I got well again, I went to Gen Con because I had always heard that Gen Con was the place to go to sell a game. So I had a copy of the game under my arm, and I went to Gen Con and talked to about 13 different publishers. And one of them really got it. They understood what I was trying to do. And that was IDW Games, who's unfortunately no longer with us, but they did kickstart Reagan's. And it was a success. It fully funded. And so there's about probably 3,000 copies of this game out in the world. And so I, you know, I have a game. I have a published game. It exists. It's a real thing that I can show to people. It's very exciting. As a result of that, it fueled my hunger to make more. I was like, I really like doing this. I love making board games. I love the activity of making board games and the kind of the craftiness of it. So I made another game, very quick one called Pantone the Game. I got licensed as Pantone the Game through Cryptozoic. And it's a fun party game. And then I made friends with the creative director at Ravensburger, and we kept in touch for many years. And eventually an opportunity came where I could pitch a game for Alien. And that ended up as Alien Fate of the Nostromo, which did very well. And then I did two of the expansions for Ravensburger for the Villainous for the Marvel games. I did Venom and the Dr. Octopus in the latest one. And then I reached out to Trick or Treat Studios, who was making horror theme games. And I like horror. I like horror board games. And so I ended up doing the Texas Chainsaw Massacre game that just came out. So I have a total of 6 games to my credit so far.
Yeah. And before that, you were working in the video game industry, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I have about 60 video games to my credit. Is some really big ones like God of War and Pac-Man World and Darksiders and things like that. Yeah. Lost SpongeBob.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I did okay in video games. You know, it's good to me. I like the industry. I still work in it, although unfortunately I have Hodgkin's lymphoma again. I have another case of it, and so I've been on disability again. So I have not been able to make any video games, but I have been working on a board game. I wanted to see, as much as I love designing them, I wanted to see if I had a little bit of what it takes to be a bit of a more of a publisher. So I did a very tiny, wasn't a Kickstarter, but it was kind of like a Kickstarter, in which I went online back in August and I said, I am going to make a board game. It's an original board game. It's going to be very limited. There's only going to be 10 copies in existence, not counting my own copy for myself. If you want it, it was, I think it was like $60 was my budget. And I said, all right, you know, let's see if there's 10 people out there that are willing to pay $60. And it filled up immediately. Like I had 60 people jump in and go, me. So I've been during my disability, right now I've been working on this. It's a little haunted house dice rolling game. Not anything, you know, very complicated, but again, I wanted to challenge myself to see if I could make like, you know, professional pieces. I'd go to like my Panda is making my meeple, special meeple for the game. And I have another company doing the map for the game. And then I also kind of put together the pieces. And then those will be hopefully shipped out, I'm hoping, by next week. So maybe they'll get to them in time for Halloween. They might just miss Halloween by a little bit, so that, you know, hopefully I've hit my deadline. So it was a fun challenge. I always say that if you want to be a game designer, you make games. And so I love making games. I love the activity of making games. And so I'm going to keep making games even past when somebody says I should stop making games. Mm. You know, I'm just going to keep making them. I don't care. I care about the audience and I care about the players. I hope they like what I make, but sometimes you just got to please yourself.
Yeah. I hope nobody tells you should stop making games.
Me too. Yeah. That would, I unfortunately am one of those people that reads the comments.
Oh, and, yeah.
So, you know, bad comments, you know, we're, us artists are are sensitive creatures. Sometimes those comments are very nasty.
Yeah.
But sometimes they're great. Sometimes they're like, this is my favorite game, or, you know, I had my whole family come over and we played this. We really had a good time, or, you know, things like that. And those to me are a huge part of what makes it worthwhile to do this. I like making things that please other people.
Yeah. How different is, in your eyes, the video game, like making a video game and making a board game?
From a design perspective, there's a lot of similarities. From a production perspective, it's very different. From a design perspective, a lot of the truths about design, which are things like you have to make sure the player understands, you know, the things that are in the game, right? So the components have to make sense. The rules have to be clear. Everything has to kind of work together and fit together. And the more thought you put into it towards the player, the better the game is. Like I remember seeing, I forget what game it was, but they had pieces or images on the board that were very particular shapes. And those shapes corresponded to the shapes of the components that you were supposed to put on the board. And I'm like, oh, that's such an easy way to get a player to do something, you know, to look at this piece. Where does it go? Oh, the leaf shaped piece goes on the place where the leaves are, you know, things like that. Some very simple things that sometimes designers forget about. Partially, I think, because not all game designers are graphic designers. And so I think it behooves game designers to try to become at least, at the very least, educated about graphic design, because it will help them in the long run.
Yeah. Yeah. User interface is, can help so much with players understanding the game.
It's huge. And it's huge in video games, right? Like video games, think about like just where your eyes go on the screen and where information pops up. And there are literally actual areas on the screen that you just shouldn't, like you should never put information unless it's a last resort. But I see games put stuff, critical stuff there all the time, and it drives me nuts. And yeah. I go, come on, didn't you read my book about video game design? We talk about this in the book. But, you know, not everybody has the benefit of reading my book or taking my classes.
Yeah. And the board game industry is, it being smaller, I feel like there is even less rules as to, you know, stuff that, I mean, there's definitely a lot of stuff that you shouldn't do, or that, like, if you spend a lot of time thinking about, you'll figure out, like, better ways to do things.
Sure. But I mean, that's part of the reason why I wrote my book, Your Turn.
Yeah.
The Guide to Great Tabletop Game Design. Because it's very easy to forget things. Like myself, my career is not very long. It's technically 2015 is when I started seriously working on ray guns until now, right? I kind of consider my career started in 2015, even though I made a go at it in 2005. I kind of lament not having those 10 years as a published game designer. But whatever, it is what it is. But, you know, so I've been making games for a little less than 10 years, is it? Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be 10 years in 2025. So I've learned a lot in that short period of time. And I see a lot of people, I go online a lot, I'm on a lot of the Facebook groups, and I see a lot of the same questions asked over and over again by people. And so I'm hoping that Your Turn addresses those questions. So that way, at least Your Turn isn't just a book about the basics. It's more advanced than that. It goes deeper than that, but it will answer those questions that, you know, novices are asking, and it will provide answers and reminders for more advanced designers.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a little anecdote on this little theme. So what I've been doing since about 2020, I started a company that does play testing for a lot of people I work with are just new creators, so they're probably running their first Kickstarter. Some of them are already established publishers, but like a lot of things that I see, and I often joke about this, is like something I'll see new designers do is they'll have like, you know, a random deck, let's say. So it's a deck that you draw from, which can have like a positive or a negative thing. But like sometimes they'll want to punish players by having a card that's like skip your next turn. And so I always say, you know, you can't really have fun skipping your turn. You don't want players to like that to be their negative interaction, unless the game is Russian roulette. Yeah. then it's great.
Yeah. The whole point of a game is to play it. And so anything that prevents the player from playing the game is a negative in my book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in your turn, I say that, right. I'm like, you know, don't do this. This is there are certain types of mechanics and mechanisms that are very old fashioned, and they're usually what people who are inexperienced in playing games use a lot. So I find that a lot of people, you know, if you ask them what board games have they played, it's usually Monopoly, Candyland, Sorry, you know, things like that. Very simple. They're mass market games, but they're games that have their roots in kind of the early days of published, like, you know, mass produced board games. And so that's all they know. And the goal of myself and a lot of other friends is to, you know, take those players gently by the hand and go, okay, those are games that you've played and you've learned things from them. In some cases, not a lot. Like Candyland, really, the two things that are good about Candyland is how to learn your colors and how to take a turn. And then once you've learned those two things, you should just throw Candyland away, or give it, actually even better, give it to some, donate it to some, you know, some other younger child or kindergarten or a library or something. But there are games that will help the players move on, right? And that's another thing that I do a lot in your turn, is it's really riddled with game suggestions. And also, like, at the end of each chapter, I talk about, you know, here are 10 games of this genre, because the book is divided up by genres of games, party games, dice games, card games, Euro games, abstract games, and thematic games. I wanted to have a chapter in miniature games, but we ran out of time. My publisher said, cut it. So maybe in the second edition. With each of those genres, I not only go over the history of them to kind of teach you where they came from and why, you know, why they are what they are. We then talk about the mechanisms that you use for those types of games, they're kind of the predominant mechanisms. And that's not to say that dice rolling mechanisms aren't going to show up in a Euro game or a thematic game or something like that. We also talk about look, roll and move is a perfectly good mechanism in the right game.
Yeah.
But if you just roll the dice and move your mice, it's not as satisfying. You know, it's just kind of rote, right? You're following what the dice does, and that doesn't give you any choice. And choice is the first and best thing you can give a player.
Yeah. Do you think that the audience is... Or have you seen the audience become more educated?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We're light years ahead, just even in 10 years. We're light years ahead of where we were. If you go to, where do you live, Ivan?
I live in Bulgaria.
Oh, okay. All right. So I don't know if there are any Targets in Bulgaria.
There are not, but I'm well aware of Target. I grew up in Illinois. All
right. Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Good. But if you go into Target today, like I was actually in Target today, and I looked at the shelf and I was amazed at the selection of games you know, there are things like Everdale and Wingspan and Catan, of course, and just all these, you know, the new hotness as well as some of the old, you know, Carcassonne. They're like all at Target, which 5 years ago would have Catan and Carcassonne, but not Wingspan and not Everdale. And 5 years before that, you were lucky to find Carcassonne, maybe Catan in the store, right? Like the hobby market has become very visible to the world. So people are now aware of this and they are starting to dip their toe, or, you know, or they're jumping whole headed, right? Like, you know, I'm sure I haven't talked to Scott Alden in a while about this, but I'm sure the number of users on BoardGameGeek is probably, you know, hugely increased since, you know, the early days, right?
Definitely.
So yeah, I'm pretty sure that the world is very aware of board games and that they are more than just Monopoly. And I mean, granted, though, some of them think it's Cards Against Humanity and Exploding Kittens and things like that.
See, I'm actually pretty impressed when I see a game like Exploding Kittens, because it takes the mass market audience and it feels like it's a step up, a very small step up from the...
Elon is very smart and he knows what he's doing. He's just as good a marketer as he is a game designer. And so, yeah, you look at the, you know, Poetry for Neanderthals and Throw Burrito and all the avocado game, all very clever, very hooky, right? They all have a cute little something. They're based on like very simple things that people understand, burritos and cavemen and, you know, cats and things like that. And he's, you know, there's a reason why his game is such a big moneymaker.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And in getting those games into so many people's hands, I think that those are the types of games that are like educating and like lifting up the,
they are, but what's interesting about it is what Elon told me when I asked him about, Exploding Kittens and the other games. He was like, you know, the point of the game is the game itself is, you know, obviously something you want to sell and should be appealing, but really what the goal is to kind of make a party out of it. So when he was making Exploding Kittens, he hit like his target, I think, you know, literally within like 24 hours or probably even less. And then he was like, well, what do I do now? And it was like, let's have fun with it, right? And so he does that with, you know, if you go to a convention and you go to, you know, Exploding Kittens booths, they are fun. They have those giant cat kind of vending machines and there's all types of silly stuff. And he does tournaments and he does, you know, events that, you know, just get people excited and playing and laughing. And that's one of the things that he's just really great at, is making a game that gets people to laugh. I'm a little envious of that. I don't have that skill. My games are usually not as uproarious as his are.
Yeah. It's difficult. It's definitely a difficult thing to do.
It's a skill. It's a talent. It's not just a skill. It's a talent. You know, he has skill to make it. That's one thing, but it's a talent to be able to tease it out and get the player to feel the excitement and wonder and, you know, whatever that a game can possess a player to, you know, experience.
Yeah. Can you tell me what your experience was like working on games that have IPs, very famous IPs? Is it, first of all, was it something you knew from the beginning, or was it a retheme for
So Pantone, which is a IP, that was, the game originally was called Who's Who. So it's a guessing game where you put down little squares of colors and you create characters out of them. So you try to build your best representation of like Shrek or SpongeBob SquarePants or something. And then the the players have to guess what it is. And that was not IP based. I was selling it as just this party game. And when I was at Cryptozoic, the head of Cryptozoic, Corey Jones, he looked at the game, he played a few rounds, and he got this kind of mad gleam in his eye, and he said, I know exactly what IP I will put on this. And I said, what? And I thought it was going to be like DC Comics or Cartoon Network or something, because those are all IP that Cryptozoic has. Mm-hmm. And he said, Pantone. Now, I had gone to art school, so I knew what Pantone was. And I thought about it for a couple of seconds, and I'm like, yeah, it makes perfect sense. Let's do it. But in the case of Alien or Texas Chainsaw, those IP, you know, the publisher already had those IP, and they were looking for a game to go with it. Now, in the case of Alien, I was already a huge fan. I had been a big fan since childhood. So I knew all about it. I knew all the, you know, I knew how I wanted it to play. I knew I wanted to put in little Easter eggs and, you know, make sure that the game was true to somebody. If somebody like myself were playing the game, that they would be excited for the game because it had all these little Easter eggs and fun things and cool stuff. Unfortunately, the production value of the game even surpassed kind of my own vision for it. There were things that the publisher put in, like that cat jump scare that you get in the game. That was something that they thought of, and I was like, that's fantastic. That's exactly what this game needs. In the case of Texas Chainsaw, I was familiar with the IP. As a fan of horror, it's hard not to be a know about it. But I was never, I had never watched the movie through its entirety. And so the publisher of the game, he was like, oh, don't be a chicken, go watch it. So I watched the movie and I went, okay, I know. Again, I was like, okay, I know what kind of game I'd want to make, but I want to find out why people like this. And so I went online and I went on a lot of, you know, subreddits and fan sites, and I watched documentaries about the making of the film and you know, people talking about why they love the film so much. And I tried to get that spirit into the game as well. You know, I wanted to make sure that not only it was attention and the grittiness that the movie has and the, you know, the characters and all that were well represented, but I also wanted it to, you know, if somebody played it and they're a fan, they were like, oh yeah, it's Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You know, it's about trying to get the hell out of there. It's trying to find the keys and the gas to leave, like the characters in the movie were doing. And so, you know, it's Ravensburger used to call them play the movie games, you know, like their Jaws game and Alien and a few others. And that was that kind of idea. Playing the movie is what I think is important. I think that's what you want to do. That's why you buy a Texas Chainsaw Massacre game off, you know, you pick it up off the shelf, or an Alien game or an ET game or a Princess Bride game or any of those IP games, because you love the IP so much. You're like, I want to play this and experience it again.
Yeah. One thing that I was really impressed with, I read on your Twitter, is that you published your first book at 42 and your first board game at 49. And yeah, I just wanted
a bit of a late starter.
Yeah, but it's something that you hear so many people make excuses about. You know, I if I had started earlier, maybe I could, you know, make a career out of this, or I could have done it. But you actually went and and did it at this later stage. What do you think?
Well, we don't get any younger, Ivan. So you can only get older. So that was my only option.
Yeah.
The book was kind of a happy confluence of events. Level Up, the video game book. I had been working for a publisher. I kept hearing the same questions. So I would go to developers and go to help them with their game design, and I kept hearing the same questions or seeing the same problems arise over and over again. And I jokingly would say, you know, one of these days I'm just going to write a book, because that way I'd show up I'd give him my book. I'd say, read this, then let's talk. Mm. Right. So, because it will answer a lot of your questions. And so I already had an outline, like, what would I do if I was going to write a book? I had kind of an outline in my head of what I wanted to do. And then I happened to give a talk at the Game Developers Conference about level design in Disneyland. And you can still find it online. It's called Everything I Learned About Level Design I Learned from Disneyland, because I'm a big fan of the parks. And this publisher reached out to me and said, hey, I heard about your talk. Do you want to write a book? And I'm like, well, you know, what do you want? Wiley is the publisher, and they do the For Dummies books. And I said, do you want a For Dummies, you know, game design? Because they hadn't made that yet. Hmm. And they said, no, we want the Scott Rogers book of game design, which was, I think, one of the, there's a few moments in my career that were like very big moments for me. And I think that was one of them, was when they said, when the publisher said that. And so I went and I said, well, I know what that book would be. It's going to be this list of things that I had been answering. And then what the other thing I would do is I would draw, when I would design games, I would draw little cartoons to kind of, I found it easier to communicate through cartoons than through words sometimes. And so I would draw these cartoons. And so I said, I'm going to do this book. It can be filled with cartoons showing you how to do these different things. And sometimes they might just be there for fun. And so that's what Level Up is. It's this book about game design. It's very, I mean, it sold really well. I'm still getting royalty checks, you know, 10 years later, or 15 years later, actually. And it's done, you know, I've done okay. I'm not ready to retire off of it, but it's evergreen. It's a book that anyone who is interested in game design can pick up and read. And it, people often cite it. They say three things about it. They say, one, it's very easy to understand. Like the way that I describe things, it's easy to understand. Two, that it's fun to read. And so it's very appealing to people, mostly 15-year-olds. And three, they sometimes even say it's funny. And they like the cartoons and stuff. So if you're interested in a video game design book that is funny and easy to read, then please pick up Level Up.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm sure that there's a lot of overlap between video game design and board game design. So I'm sure it's a good idea, even if you're not a.
I would say that maybe the first three or four chapters of it are really applicable. And then it starts getting into things that are more specific to video game design, like, now, how do you do combat and how do you design a level and how do you there's some other level chapters on interface and stuff that are helpful as well for tabletop. But when I wrote Level Up, it did really well. It's the second edition. It's been published in 5 different languages. I really wanted to, I kind of felt like there needed to be a Level Up for tabletop game design, because I've read every video game or every tabletop game design book out there. And there's a lot of good ones, but the ones that I liked the most weren't the ones about game design. They were usually like history books. So for example, John Peterson's Playing at the World, which might be, for my money, the best book on tabletop gaming ever written. It's amazingly well researched. It's very dense. It's about the history of role playing games, at least up until Dungeons and Dragons. You know, kind of how it evolved from Kriegspiel and stuff like that. And then one of the other ones that I really love is Stuart Wood's book called Eurogames. Mm. But again, it's very hyper focused on Eurogames, where they came from. Now it does get into the mechanisms and, you know, has some reviews of games and things like that in it. But I never really felt one that, like, an aspiring game designer could pick up and kind of start from, all right, let's go. You know, that's how I work. I'm more of a roll your sleeves up and get the work kind of guy. And so I wanted a book that was that. And so with Your Turn, the Guide to Great Tabletop Game Design, it literally is, it's a workbook. as well as it's a history book, as well as it's a textbook, as well as it's a reference book of mechanisms. It's kind of all those things. So I'm hoping that people, and also I'm hoping that people find it fun to read and easy to understand. The thing about it that I'm the most excited about is that in it, I invented 6 brand new games of different genres. So card game, dice game, party game, abstract, Euro, and thematic game. But the idea is that you start with my game, which they're okay. They're not, I'm not going to say they're the world's greatest games ever, but they are fun to play. But by the end of the chapter, you have transformed the game that I had created into a game that you have created.
Yeah.
And so by the end of reading the book, you will have created 6 original board games.
Yeah. That actually is a great segue into my next question. Actually, it almost answers it. But my question is about teaching game design. Like, what would be some practical things that people can do? Because that's something that I've been asked a lot by friends who either play a lot of games and want to get into designing a game. They ask, you know, what should my first step be? And usually my answer is, one, like, enter a contest or something, like, give yourself some restriction. And like,
yeah, but a contest is, it can be tough, man. I mean, like, it's not just tough, it's like kind of cruel.
It is,
know? Like, it's very harsh. And I think that I mean it's, your advice is good advice. I wouldn't recommend it as the first thing.
Not for everyone. Yeah, so something to keep yourself accountable, I think, is why I would say. And also, it's something that I've done a lot, so that's like, I feel like it's helped.
Contests, and I've never won anything, so I don't. I'm like, well, you know, they're not good for my ego. So
yeah. I'll finish my advice and then. So then the other thing is, like, the reason I think that you just need to kind of start working on something is, like, find problems and then, like, try and solve them. And I think that's how you get better at solving problems in, any area. But, like, if you want to get better at game design, you'll come across a lot of problems, right?
Yeah, the first thing you want to do is just, like, kind of solo play the game. Like, just play it by yourself. And see if it's doing what you want it to do. Mm. Now, the problem is this. You're going to get what I call designer blinders, which is you're going to be so into your own game and you're in love with your game and you know exactly how it's supposed to be played. But that's not what happens when you put it in front of other people. And of course, games are meant to be played. We could go into a long conversation about this item, but I'm kind of in the camp that I don't quite believe that games are art, because art is only meant to be felt and thought about, where games are meant to be played. Therefore they're craft. Mm. They're like not much different than a chair, right? Like, a chair is meant to be sat on. You don't just look. I mean, there are beautiful chairs that you could look at and go, oh my God, that chair is art. But ultimately a chair is meant to be sat on. And so if it doesn't do that, it doesn't perform in that way, unless you're trying to make some statement about, you know, pointy things or something, you're meant to sit in it. So I feel the same about games, that games are a craft. So games are meant to be played. And so you have to get them in front of other people. Now, the problem is other people are horrible. They will, you know, break your heart. They will find things wrong with your game. But like you said, it's that problem solving that's the heart of game design, is iteration, is making your game, breaking it. It's like forging a sword. You are, you know, like a katana, you know, how they would like fold it over and over and over and beat it and beat it and beat it. That's what you have to do to your game. You have to play it and beat it and play it and beat it and beat out all the bad things. But the problem is there's a million decisions that you can make. And so what is the right one? Well, fortunately, we have other games to help us point the way. So if you want to learn how to do, you know, like a dice rolling game that where you're selecting the dice and then figuring out what to do with them. You know, there's games like Sagrada, or there's games like Unearth, or there's games like, you know, there's a lot of examples out there of games that point the way. And so then what you do is you copy. Now, you don't want to rip off, right? Like, you don't want to just remake Sagrada and go, da-da, here it is. But Sagrada can teach you things about dice rolling and dice placement and dice selection. And even things like, you know, color makes a difference, right? And numbers make a difference. And so there's a lot of good lessons to be learned from playing that game. And then once you play that game, you're like, okay, I have all those tools, that, those learnings in my, I say it's like your tool belt, right? Like your, or like your utility belt, like Batman. You know, you have all these tricks that you're going to be able to use as a designer. The more tricks you learn, the better you're going to be able to understand how games work. And then you're going to be able to understand how to use them. And then you're going to be able to go, this dice rolling mechanism is, might work really great in my game. Let me plug it in there. And ta-da. And then if you give it your own tweaks, right, you find some new things to do with it, or you have a different theme. Or a different, you know, objective for the players, then things are going to be different. So you're not just doing the same thing, right? So this is exactly what I'm doing in our book, in my book, in your term, is this this iteration, right? You're in your turn, you make that game that I've made, and then I say, all right, let's change a number. Let's just change a number. Let's do it easy. What's a number we could change? Well, we could change the number on the dice. We could go from a 6-sided die to an 8-sided die, or a 12-sided die, or a 20-sided die. Or we could reduce the number of elements in the game. Instead of having 30 cards in the deck, let's see what we can do with 12. Or we could reduce the amount of money, or give more money to the player so that when they start the game. So that way, if they have more money, they have more choices and more things to do because they have more resources. So that's like step one. And then in the book, we keep changing stuff. We change rules. We change components. We change objectives. And then we change the theme. And all these make huge differences to the game as you go. And then, by the end of it, you have a game that's very different than the one we started with. But it's your game, right? Yeah. It's not my game. And that's the benefit of playing as many games as you can, even bad ones. Like, play bad games. If you hear, oh, that game's terrible, play it anyway, just because you're going to learn things from it. And then you're going to also learn what you don't like. And that contributes towards taste, right? Every creator needs to have taste. And so there's, you know, you'll notice that a Wolfgang Warsch game is, you know, very different than a Emin Larkin's game, you know, because they have different tastes.
Yeah.
Right. They're interested in different things.
Yeah. I
don't know if that answers your question.
It totally does. It totally does. And I find so many points where I feel like, you know, that is kind of what I've done with a lot of the games I've started. Sometimes it's this game meets this game, like, or this mechanic meets this mechanic.
Yeah, it's a great way to start, right? That kind of Frankensteining is a great, like even better is when you play a game and you go, oh, I didn't like this game. I thought it was going to be this. Or what I do, sometimes what I'll do is I'll go on to like the Board Game Geek news page, and I'll look at the new games that are coming out, and I'll try to imagine what those games are before I even read about them. And a lot of times I'm just completely wrong. But now I've got a new game because it's different than that one that is out there, right? So then I can go, is this something I want to work on and devote my time and energy to?
Yeah.
But ultimately, like you said, getting that game out there, like getting it, like making it. So, you know, obviously you want to finish something, right? That's step one. Step two is getting it, playing it yourself and seeing if you like it. And if you're somewhat satisfied with it, or you think it's doing what you want it to do, then you get it in front. I always suggest getting it in front of other game designers first, because other game designers already have that language of game design. And so they're going to cut to the quick. They're going to help you get through the bullshit of that little haunted house game that I was making. I played it. I played it myself. I then played it with my family, which is I often advise people not to do until later, because family is often they'll be like, oh, your games are great and wonderful. But in my family, my son is brutal about, he's a really good, he's very critical. And so he'll cut to the quick and just go, this is bullshit. Do this. Do, you know, this is good. You might want to, you know, but it's not as good as it could be. You need to make it better, whatever. He doesn't always often offer solutions, but he's good at problem finding.
Yeah. Well, right? that's the big thing, right? Because, you know, that famous quote that, when 99% of the time, if somebody offers or sees a problem, they're right. And yeah. If they offer a solution, they're probably wrong, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Totally. That's a great quote.
Yeah.
I'm going to steal that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's totally true. Right. And that's the thing, as a game designer, the other thing you need to do is you need to kind of hold on to the heart of your game. Like, kind of figure out like what was the thing that excited you the most about making this game in the first place. And I always write that down. The camera isn't on, but I have a stack of notebooks behind me, and I am on volume 49.
Wow.
I have 49 notebooks of game ideas and just, you know, writing down. When I do playtests, I write all my playtest feedback in my books. What I do is I write down that heart of the game, that little, thing to keep your eye on. What do I want to do with this game, right? So for like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I wanted to be a game that was grimy and tension filled and about like hurriedly scrambling to try to find something. Right. Like that's what I wanted that game to be about. Oh, and I also wanted, there's a draw bag in it, and I wanted the experience of reaching into the draw bag to be terrible. Mm. Like I wanted you to dread reaching into that draw bag. And I've been hearing from people that have played the game. They're like, yeah, I hate that draw bag. Yeah. And I'm like, success. Yeah. You know, that's what I wanted. I wanted them to dislike it. You know, it's kind of a weird thing to make as an objective of the game, but I wanted to see if it was possible to do. And because that's horror, right? Horror is about dread and you know, tension and all that. It's hard to do jump scares in board games, but you can do dread and you can do tension.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to see if I could do this in a board game. So that heart, that little heart of the game, that you as a designer, you have to hang on to that. So when you get feedback are like bullets bouncing, you know, off of that heart. And sometimes there's a good bullet that goes in and you go, oh, that makes it better. That makes the game better. But a lot of times there are things that don't help, right? Because a lot of the people, you know, in many cases, a lot of the people that you're getting playtest are not as educated, right? That's why I always suggest starting with educated people first. So what I suggest in your turn is that you find friends that have made games. You know, they don't have to be published game designers, but they do have to be people who have made games that understand what it takes to make a game. So they're going to give you kind of the best feedback. Then you take it to gamers who have played a lot of games and they have opinions about games, right? And they'll look at your game and go, oh, your game is just this meets that. And you go, okay, that's sure. That's what it started as, but I want it to be more than that.
Yeah.
So then you play with them and they're the ones that will kind of tear things apart and not be able to give you great. Sometimes they'll give you good advice, sometimes not. But those are usually, you know, that's why you go to like the playtest, like your playtest group that you have, mm-hmm. right? That's a perfect forum for that. Then after that, you go to your friends and family and have them play it. And they're going to maybe be a little easier on you. Depends on your family. But they'll be able to tell you whether the game is fun or not. Because if they're having fun playing it, then you know you have a fun game. Yeah. And then finally, you want a blind play test, right? You want to send it out to the world to people who have never, you know, who don't even know who you are in some cases, and have them play it. And then they'll give you feedback. And that's honest feedback, right? They're very honest in that blind play testing. And also, that's the best way to test your rules.
Yep.
You know, if you have badly written rules, then a blind play tester is going to be like, I couldn't play your game because we didn't understand what the hell was going on.
Yeah, for sure. sure. And that's the service that we offer, blind playtesting.
Yeah, that sounds great. It's too bad you're in Budapest. I could use something
in Bulgaria. Well, we do everything online.
Bulgaria.
Yeah, because we use Tabletop Simulator, and sometimes we do print and plays, and we do videos of the session, which I find as a designer, because I've done it with my own projects as well, I found it horrifying watch a blind playtest. But you learn a lot.
I have kind of a love-hate relationship with Tabletop Simulator. I you know, it was a savior during the pandemic. It's probably one of the better tools for prototyping, although there are certain things it just can't do. I don't know. Maybe it's better. I haven't gone on it in a while. Maybe they've added some features. But it is great for play. It's really great for demoing.
Yeah.
Like if you have a game and you're like, let me show you. We're not going to play the whole game, but let me kind of show you how it works. Yeah. I've done a lot of pitches through Tabletop Simulator. I think it's a great tool for that.
Yeah. Well, for me, I use it so much because it's. A lot quicker for prototyping. There's no cutting involved, which I'm very, very sick of cutting. But also,
well, that's why you get one of those guillotines. You know?
Yeah, yeah. No, I've got those. I still prefer that PNG, just dragging and dropping, copying the link. But the other thing that it's done is, you know, I can work with people. Like right now, I'm actually working on a project with Adrian Adamesco, who's one of the designers of Sagrada, and he lives in Canada. Nice. And we were doing a project remotely, with Sam McDonald, who lives in New Zealand. We've got another project going on, and it's so cool that like you're no longer limited by your immediate surrounding, but you can.
That's fantastic. That particularly that you're getting code, you know, doing code design, right? Working with code designers.
Yeah,
it's something that I have not. I don't know. Maybe it's my personality or what. But I have not been able to. Not that I've had a couple of attempts that we've started and they were fun and we made some interesting stuff. But nothing that's actually been sold or anything like that. But working with if you find a good partner, stick with. Right, because that's like gold. Like finding a design partner is a fantastic thing. And I know some designers that it's almost exclusively all they do. Like I know Daryl Andrews. You know, he is a huge code. He does almost all his games are code designs.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I don't really have a lot of insight into that because I haven't done it. And so I'm not. Always clear, like that's really, I think, the next step in my education is to talk to some of these people that do code designs and kind of go, all right, what do you do? What's your process? How do you do this? You know, I mean, maybe I could reverse interview you, Ivan. You can tell me all about.
Well, that's exactly the opposite. Like for me, it looks so much more difficult to do games alone. And I've tried. I have one small little. Micro game, which is like a solo game that I did by myself, and I did a little roll and write contest by myself. But it's been so much harder for me because you can't bounce ideas off of anyone, and so
you could always ask Chat GPT.
Yeah, that's something that I recently experimented with. Like
Let me clear my position on this. I think AI in general I don't like it for the finished product. I don't like AI art. I think it's kind of creepy and weird and squishy looking. I would much rather hire an artist. Matter of fact, I went through an exercise last summer where I spent like months with Midjourney and DALL-E trying to get images. I was like, I want to just see if I can create one image with this very particular set of parameters. I'm working on a board game that's it's crazy. It's a aerial combat farming game. But it's in this world of anthropomorphic foxes. They're all the pilots of these biplanes. And so I'm like, all right, I want a picture of a fox flying a biplane over a farm, you know, in Central California. And so I tried for months to try to get these images out of these AIs, and they just couldn't do it. They just were not, everything was turned out either bizarre or just, you know, just weren't, you know, they weren't professional quality imagery. And I ended up hiring an artist. There was a fellow, Tristan Rossum, who's a really great artist. He was like, hey, I've got a break in my schedule. You know, does anybody want to need some art? And I'm like, yes, I do. I'm going to leap at that chance to work with, you know, an artist of his caliber. Absolutely. And so I ended up, you know, I had some money set aside and I ended up commissioning him to do the art piece. And of course, he knocked it out of the park, right? Because he's a human and he understands what the hell I'm talking about. And he's not going to like make everything look weird. He's going to make it work. And so I think from a concepting point of view, it was a good exercise and it kind of got my brain to think about, you know, what exactly do I want, you know, in the picture and all that. But it, the final product was garbage.
Yeah.
And so I've seen images recently that are much more impressive. But it still can't do certain things. It doesn't do action very well. It does like kind of stoic, you know, characters just standing there. Okay. It does environments great. Like it does beautiful environments, but it doesn't, but people, environments aren't what people are interested in. And people are interested in characters and stories.
Yeah.
And so I don't think that
go ahead. Beige Euro covers.
And what?
Beige Euro covers, like the old
beige,
German.
Is beige the new blue?
No, I'm kidding. You know, those old German games that have very little theme
but still you get, I mean, even though a lot of those are really boring covers, you also get the cover of Kalis, which is maybe, you know, one of the more iconic covers in board gaming, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. But again, that's about a person, right? He's a grumpy, I forget what he is, like a burgermeister or a overseer or something. Yeah. But that grumpy guy, you know, that tells a lot about the story. I mean, it doesn't tell you much about the game, but it does tell you a little bit about the story, which is there's some grumpy guy in this game. And then you play the game and you go, oh, that's, you know, that's this character that's kind of marching down the path.
Yeah. What is the most difficult game design problem you've faced?
How to make a successful ongoing game, an evergreen game, right? That's like what Elon Lee seems to do so effortlessly, right? Like something like that, you know, something that's simple and silly and easy. So my wife, she's a source of inspiration in that most of the games that she loves are very simple. So things like Uno and Farkle and stuff like that. So I'm always trying to think of a game, like what kind of game could I design for my wife? And the closest I've come is Pantone, which was just an idea that kind of hit me out of the blue. But that's her favorite. Yeah, of all the games I've made so far, that's her favorite because it's very simple. And so, but the problem with Pantone is it isn't very well known and it's not making me a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So I want one that is simple and fun and appeals to my wife, but also makes me a lot of money and preferably is one that's going to be in the stores for a while, you know? So that's the goal. That's not all the games that I'm working on. I'm working on, you know, I mean, like any game designer, I'm working on a ton of games of all different genres, you know, everything from horror games to the Euro farming game to actually Euro horror game, you know, things like that. But then that simple, you know, always trying to find that inspiration for that simple game that maybe could turn into an evergreen game. Of course, part of it is you got to have the right publishing partner too. And there's only, you know, so many people on the shelves of Target and Walmart and all that. And a lot of them already have a ton of games kind of filling up space. You know, if I had my druthers, you know, I would, you know, clear out the majority of the Cards Against Humanity section at Target and try to fill it up with other games because they take up a huge footprint.
Yeah.
Right. But they take up a huge footprint because they're wildly successful. So I'm like, how do I get that wildly successful? Where's that lightning in a bottle? And the problem is I don't think you can capture it knowingly.
Yeah, of course.
I think it has to just come. Yeah. As inspiration.
Well, just last week when I interviewed Adrian, who's Daryl Andrews' partner in Sagrada, mm-hmm. and I asked him, did he have any idea when they were making Sagrada? Because that's their most successful game, definitely. Did he have any idea that it would be a hit? And he said that at the time, he was certain that another one of his games would do so much better than Sagrada. And it's like the complete opposite. Like he said that game did just a lot worse.
That's almost always the case though, right? Like particularly for creative people. First of all, almost all creative people, except for maybe Matt Fantastic. He is the most self-assured dude I've met in the board game industry. A lot of creators, we have imposter syndrome. We doubt ourselves. We're like, I don't know if, at a certain point you're like, I don't know if this game's any good or not. I just want it to be done, And so, I'd say if you asked, probably 98% of the game designers out there, did you know this game was going to be a big hit? Particularly of the successful game designers, mm-hmm. they'd be like, I didn't have, I wasn't sure. They'd either be like, I wasn't sure, or I had no idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
But nobody does. Nobody knows.
Right? Yeah.
Nobody knows until it happens. And a lot of times it just turns out to be the right game at the right time, published by the right person, sold in the right place.
Yeah, like Wingspan. Like nobody would have guessed that theme of, bird watching.
I don't know. I think Jamie's a very smart guy, and I think that game, as far as I know, was always about birds, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so.
Elizabeth is such a big, birder fan. So I think that it was in there, but I think that the game, I've heard, these are more rumors than anything else, but I've heard that the game was not, it was a very different game. And so, under Jamie's tutelage, it became what it was. So it was that combination of young novice game designer with an enthusiasm for birds and Jamie, a very experienced, very successful, knowledgeable game designer who knew how to make good games. And I think that, that partnership is what made that game what it was.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. No, a lot went right with that game. But it seems to have mass market appeal. I think a lot of that is the theme as well. And mm-hmm.
Well, it's very different.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You look on the shelf and you look at, the different, well, this used to be more true through, when did Wingspan come out? 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah.
5, 6 years ago? It's been a while.
Yeah. Right
before the pandemic. When that game came out, you'd look at the board game, the wall of board games, right? And it was either Euro games about building cities or building farms or whatever, or it was, thematic games about fighting monsters or dungeon crawling or whatever. And there was no bird game about birds. It was completely untouched territory. Now, of course, there are a few more games about birds, but there mostly is more games about that kind of coziness,
Yeah.
The anthropomorphic animals and things like that. Yeah. And like building a cottage or running a little shop in a village or something. Yeah. Or sitting at home. And make it having a blanket.
Or yeah, like Calico, that cover.
Yeah,
like
Calico or Creature Comforts or those type of games. Now that's the market, right? Like that's the new hot. Well, it's even a little, I'd say it's even a little passé now, right? Like we're past that. what's the next new thing? That's the real question.
Yeah. Well, what do you think the next new thing is?
I don't know. If I knew that, I'd be rich. I don't know. I have a couple of ideas of things that might be coming back around again. A lot of things can be cyclical.
Mm.
Like, I know that IP games are kind of not on their way out, but they're definitely being de-emphasized. And I think that, you know, more original games are probably coming back into style. You know, there's always things that, there's always genres that will end up being in board games.
Yeah.
Farming and city building and zombies and pirates and Cthulhu. You know, those will always pop up at some point or another. The question is, will any of them ever be huge hits? I don't know. I think that there needs to be, well, like, we're in this era of hybridization, and I think that there needs to be some sort of new hybrid that pops up that embraces what's good about a couple of different types of games, or maybe, you know, with a quirky theme, but not too weird. Because I have a theory. It's in Level Up. It's called the Triangle of Weirdness. I don't know if you're familiar with
it. No, I'm not.
So the Triangle of Weirdness is this observation I made, which is usually a product. It can be a movie or a comic book or a video game or a board game, where there are three axioms on the triangle, three angles on the triangle. One is the people or the characters, usually the person in a video game is who the player is playing. The second is the world in which the character is in. And then the third is the actions that those characters are doing. And you can have one of those be kind of weird. For example, you could have your character be an anthropomorphic fox, right? Mm. That's a little weird. But you can't have the things that they do or the places that they are be weird also.
Yeah.
Because if you have too many weird things, you're gonna alienate your audience. And I've seen firsthand, I've worked on video games that had a weird environment and a weird character and you're doing weird things.
Yeah.
And the game ended up being
a weird game.
Well, yeah, it was a weird game. Yeah, but it ended up being well known, but it didn't reach the financial level that other games did.
Yeah.
And I believe that part of the reason why they didn't do as well is because they were a little too weird.
Yeah.
And so we have to be careful of that, because players want familiarity. They want things that are familiar. They want things to make sense, right? Like, if you are putting water in a bucket, well, what are you going to do with that water? Are you going to water some plants? Are you going to brush your teeth out of it? Are you going to dump it on somebody's head? It has to make sense, right?
Yeah. The
things that you're doing have to make sense. Or if you have weird actions, if you're doing kind of weird things, the characters and the world have to be less weird, right? The three models that I use in Level Up is Wizard of Oz has weird characters.
Mm-hmm.
But the world that they're in isn't that weird. They're like, you know, it's a forest and castles and stuff. And the things that they want, the actions that they do are not weird. Like, their motivations aren't weird. Like, they just want to go home, or they want to be brave, or they want to be smart. These are all things that we can relate to. Star Wars has a weird world. Like, there's weird, you know, it's a weird desert planet, and Wookiees, and the Death Star is kind of a weird place. But the characters are not weird. They're a farm boy and a, you know, princess, but we know what a princess is.
Yeah, and it's about family as well.
Yeah, it's about family, but it's also about being hero, like wanting to be a hero and save the day and rescue the princess. And then the third one is Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which has knights, which are, you know, they're old enough that we're very familiar with them. So they're not, knights aren't really weird. The place that they're doing their stuff in is medieval England, which is not, you know, it's once again, forests and castles, not very weird. But all the things they're doing are weird, right? They're knocking coconuts together to pretend like they're on horses, or they build a big rabbit to sneak in, or they you know, bang on their heads and stick their tongues out and act like fools. And so those, to me, at least in movies, are the three, like, kind of prime examples of the triangle of weirdness. Because if any one of those other elements was weird, it would have alienated the audience and it wouldn't have been a big success. But all three of those are huge successes. And so I'm like, look, there's some sort of correlation between these two things. We have to be mindful of this as creators.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic.
And tons of other examples. Like, I can do it with Harry Potter. I can do it with The Matrix.
Yeah.
I can do it with comic. There's certain comic books I can do it with. Things like that.
Yeah. The Sandman.
The Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah.
You know, they're all, they're huge hits because they didn't violate the triangle of weirdness.
Yeah. That's something that I read. Like, one of my hobbies outside of board games is I do stand up and I read a lot of books on comedy, and they have a very similar rule. Like, you either have a comedic character in a normal world, or you have a comedic world with a normal character, and that immediately
Now, which one are you when you do your stand up?
You can do both. You can definitely do both.
I mean, do you have like a character, or are you just Ivan?
I think I bring out different parts of like real, or I focus on something very a small aspect of myself, but I kind of make it a little bit bigger. Yeah. Usually, I think I'm the weird character. So like, yeah. But definitely a similarity.
For sure.
What are some of your, can you name like three of your favorite games? And then what would be your dream sort of mechanic theme combo, or a dream game for you to make in the future that you haven't made yet?
Right. My favorite games. I always get asked this question.
That's okay. Well, it can be different every time.
Number one is The Trailed House on the Hill. Mm-hmm. It was the game that kind of brought me back into board gaming in a way. Like, early 2000s, I heard somebody told me and said, hey, there's this game, this board game that is has 50 different endings. And I'm like, 50 different endings? How does that work? I gotta see this for myself. And I played it and I fell in love with it, mainly because it had a lot of elements that I love about board games, which is I love miniatures. I love, and that's from me playing Dungeons and Dragons. I love modular boards, so that way you're never getting the same experience twice. And I like the horror genre, you know, the sneaking through a haunted house and, you know, kind of forming around you as you went. I thought it was very clever. And I played it many times, and I've never played all 50 endings, but I've probably played about 25 of the endings. And I just fell in love with it. And I'm like, wow, this is totally different. I mean, it's like D&D, but it's not. It's like D&D without a dungeon master. That's one of the things I liked about it. The second game that I love, Quacks of Quedlinburg. Is a brilliant design. I love the draw mechanic. I like, now, granted, the one thing I will argue against is it's not a game about herbologists. It's a game about witches. I think that he changed the theme just to make it more commercially viable, maybe in Germany. But to me, that game is you're a witch brewing a pot. But that said, I love the game. I love the visual of the, like, the pot in front of you when you're putting the little tiles. And I have those resin tiles that you can get on Board Game Geek.
Yeah.
And oh my God, that makes the game so much better. Like, just the feel of those resin tiles. I'm a big, like, I love the physical experience of board games.
Yeah.
And just changing that one component, the tile from cardboard, little cardboard chips, to resin tiles made a huge difference.
Yeah.
Third favorite game. I don't know. I haven't played it in a while, but I really love the Star Wars X-Wing miniatures game.
Mm-hmm.
Partially because I love the little, I like anything that makes a little world in front of me. And the Star Wars game I love partially because it's boardless. I haven't played the second edition, but I was really into the first edition. And I love the, you know, the beauty of the models, the, how, you know, they came pre-painted. They were, they're lovely. And I love the, I love the mechanism of the game. I love how I have almost never played the game with the cards. You know, there's the little pilot cards and the ability cards and all that. I've never played with those. I've just played, I played one game with it and I'm like, all right, this is pretty cool. But I like, but I usually end up, a lot of it is I've used it in class as a teaching tool to show, hey, look, you don't need a board to make a board game. You know, here's a, here's a miniatures game. And I love the, you know, the hidden, all right, we're going to hide what we're going to do. And okay, 1, 2, 3 reveal. That's a great moment in that game. And then it feels like Star Wars, right? You're flying around and blasting at each other, and it's really a good time. So that's, I like, there's a lot I really like about that flying. That's part of the reason why I'm making this flying, crazy flying game, is I love that, that Star Wars game so much.
Yeah. And I did have a second question, which was me being a bad interviewer and giving multiple questions at the same time. But the second question was, what mechanics, what would be like your dream game, a game that you haven't made yet, but you'd love?
Yeah, now I was going to ask you what my favorite mechanic was in the game, which is very, it's the haunt dice in Betrayal at House on the Hill, because it's beautiful. It's, you know, the bad thing is coming and you have to roll the dice. And then when it happens, you're like, but a lot of times you're like, you just barely miss it. And you're like, oh, thank God, you know, we have still a few more turns to try and gather stuff. So that's a, that's my favorite mechanism. And that's part of the reason why I like Betrayal. Is that mechanism? It's brilliant design. My dream game.
Yeah, one that you'd love to design.
Well, it was Riggins and Rocket Ships, right? Like that was the game I wanted to make. It was this, you know, big sprawling sci-fi. Well, not, it's not that big. It's a skirmish game, but it's a, you know, kind of a sci-fi, you know, action game. I really would love to make a board game. Like I would love to make the board game equivalent of The Mandalorian. You know, I would love to make a game where you are a space bounty hunter and you're traveling around and there's all types of bad guys and you're trying to, you know, track them down, and then they might get away from you and you have to chase them down. And then you have other players who are bounty hunters that are trying to get the bounty as well. And, you know, the bounty is going up and everybody is like, ooh, I really want that big bounty guy, but he's tough to fight. I need to make sure I have the gear and the weapons and maybe some allies or something to help me through this. And so I kind of imagine something like, kind of like a mix of Zaya, the, you know, the was it the Legends of Adrift system or something? I kind of see it a bit like that, but I kind of see it a bit like Star Wars Outer Rim, which is a really fun game. And I see it a bit like, a little bit like Kingdom Death Monster, which has like really good character building, you know, like you're slotting gear into your characters and, you know, that kind of thing. And a lot of dungeon crawlers have that kind of mechanism.
Yeah. Awesome. So final question, we've gone on quite a bit because it's super interesting.
The sun has come up.
The sun has come up. Yeah, we started when it was dark here. Last question I ask all designers is, what would your advice be to somebody who's new to design, who hasn't designed yet? How would you tell them?
Just finish your work, get it done, right? Like ideas are a dime a dozen. Unfinished prototypes aren't going to ever be a game. You want to get that game made, you want to get it played, and then you want to get it into that iterative cycle as fast as you can. Now, sometimes you can break up pieces, right? Like you might say, oh, I have a system for combat. Let's test this out. And then you can plug it back into your bigger game or something like that. So, but whatever you make, just get it to the point where you can make it playable.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. And
pleasure, Ivan. This was great.
Yeah, I'll share all links to all of your books in the description, and
You mean books like Your Turn, The Guide to Great Tabletop Game Design, which is available on, I think you can order it on Amazon, a pre-order. It comes out October 31st.
Yes, like Your Turn, which comes out on October 31st on Amazon, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and on it's at Barnes & Noble, and it's at Wiley.com and several other places. And then I also have the Texas Chainsaw Massacre game, which is out by Trick or Treat Studios. And you can get that at trickortreatstudios.com and Amazon and several other places. And then hopefully it'll be showing up in stores soon. And then the other thing that's very exciting is I've been on the History Channel. I was on last week. They have a show called The Toys That Built America. I don't know if the History Channel is in Europe or anything, but I think you can get it through streaming. If you don't have it on your cable or whatever. And then I'm going to... So last week I was talking about the game Yahtzee. And then this week I'll be talking about Nintendo and the unsung hero of Nintendo, Gunpei Yokai. So if you like video games, you should check that out.
Yeah. Fantastic. Thank you again. It was really a pleasure for me.
Thank you, Ivan. This was really great. And... I wish all your gamers and playtesters the best, just keep at it, right? Making games is one of the best. If you can make a living at making games, that's the best thing ever.
Yeah.
So keep at it.